One of the things that Miriam Suzanne realized early in her developer journey is that web development is a tool. She wanted to build a website for her theater company and ended up building a career and a company around it. And not just that, but she also joined the CSS Working Group, the official standards body that determines how the CSS stack evolves. In this show, we talk about her early discovery of the power of the web, how she joins creativity with technical prowess, and how CSS is really like poetry written in a browser. Enjoy this episode of the Work Item Podcast. I am your host, Dan Delamarski. Miriam, Suzanne, welcome to the Work Item. I am so excited to be talking to you today.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
Why don't we start with the most important question of this podcast? Because it's all about careers, it's all about career growth. I want to start with, what are you doing these days? What are you building?
Oh, geez. how is that always the hardest question? I've been spending most of my time working with the CSS Working Group to build new CSS features into the language, which is an interesting project. And then also, I run and work with the team at Oddbird. We do all sorts of client work that ranges from design systems to greenfield builds of applications and websites and refactors, whatever clients need. And we're available for work.
For the uninitiated, what is the CSS Working Group? Because, you know, I have not been really involved that much in web development and web standards. And I'm assuming it is a web standards body, but maybe you can tell us more.
Yeah, the CSS Working Group is part of the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, which is the main standards body for the web. Although, interestingly, CSS is the only of the three main technologies, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. CSS is the only one still managed by the W3C. And the working group is the group that writes the specifications. It's made up of people from the browser vendors. There's Chrome and Microsoft and Apple and Mozilla folks there. And then also some of us that are just invited as CSS authors who get to have some input. And then a bunch of other companies, really any member company of the W3C. And that's, you know, it includes Adobe and a bunch of other companies that have a stake on the web, even if they're not building a browser. It's a lot of companies represented, and then also some of us that are not representing companies but are just representing CSS authors.
So you've been writing about CSS for some time, and actually I discovered your work through some of the CSS writing that you've done in the past. What bootstrapped that interest for you in the web? Like, what was the starting point? It's like, I want to build for the web.
Yeah, I never had that moment. It's funny. I studied theater and creative writing. Out of college, I was running a theater company in Indiana, and we needed a better website. We needed somewhere to post shows, and I wanted a better way to do that. So I asked my brother, who had built several websites, if he would build one for us, and he said, no, but I'll show you how. And he did. And he linked me to several different places. I mean, it was the heyday of blogs. It was like really when the blogosphere was taking off. So I was reading, you know, Nicole Sullivan and Eric Meyer and Jeffrey Zeldman and Natalie Down, all these people writing great material about specifically open standards. I mean, it was the web standards project was really going, a lot of excitement around CSS. And there was one site that grabbed me in particular, which was Eric Meyer's CSS Edge. He had this weird playground of hacks that you could do in CSS that would achieve things that otherwise didn't seem possible on the web. And I got obsessed with those sort of weird things you could do with CSS and started playing with it. And then, you know, I built the website for our theater And then another theater in town wanted a website, and then my band needed a website, and it just sort of spiraled. People needed websites. It turns out that is a good way to pay for your theater habit.
And it sounds like it definitely kind of sprung from almost like necessity. Like you had a project in mind, you wanted to do that, and you started exploring kind of the space from those early roots. So it was not more like a, oh, hey, I'm going to go and learn CSS for the sake of learning CSS.
Right. No, it was definitely, I wanted to do things. And then, I mean, I had art projects in mind. I mean, a lot of the early stuff was my own personal websites, playing around with different ideas. What can I make it do? I mean, it feels theatrical to me, the web. There's something like you write a script and then it's performed by the different browsers, and you get to see these differences in the performance, and that's interesting, and people are interacting with it. There's sort of a live performance aspect to what we do that tied in with my interests, so I kept doing it.
I find this a fascinating part of your work is that you're not just a technologist, but you also combine this interest in art. And you've done some significant work before. You know, you again involved with W3C, you wrote for CSS Tricks, you've been involved in Mozilla, and at the same time, you have the kind of intersection with the art space. How has that influenced your work? Because I don't know that many technologists that combine those seemingly two very disjoint worlds.
I'm never sure how unique it is, because I've also been in the front-end world, in the CSS world in particular, I find that there are particularly a lot of musicians. Like everybody's in a band or got a music degree and then went into writing CSS. And I think there's something interesting about that combo particularly, where music is sort of this mathematical art, and so is CSS. It's like using math to make art. So I think there are a lot of people doing it, but it has, I mean, the influence has gone both ways. I think both in theater and in design and design engineering, there's sort of this, how do I be creative on a deadline with a budget? How do I use the constraints of the budget and the deadline and the client and whatever else? How do I use those constraints to inspire something better? Okay, we don't have the budget for this amazing thing that I imagined, but what if I can do something cheaper that's even cooler? What if I can use that constraint to create something more interesting? And I think, you know, client work has a different sort of set of constraints than fine art work, I guess, but both have constraints. Both are thinking about an audience. How do I bring the audience along in this? How do I communicate something? And yeah, I think there's a lot of tricks that sort of flow either direction in that.
You called out kind of working under constraints. And to me, it's one of those drivers of creativity. Like once you have the constraints set, like you have this box you have to operate in. How do you figure out your way out of it?
Right.
And what you're describing is like you have to be creative about it, because the constraints kind of breed that creativity.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I really like, you know, not just saying, well, the constraint kept me from doing the cool thing, so I'll do something less cool. And instead thinking like, okay, how do I use that constraint to push me in a different direction that's going to actually be even more interesting? Like sometimes in theater, it's less interesting to have magic happen. And it's more interesting if you can see how it's done. You see somebody doing the magic can actually, I don't know, be more magical in some way. Hiding the strings isn't always the answer. And it tends to be the answer we go for when there's budget for it. So sometimes not having the budget makes you think, okay, how do I show the strings here?
There's a certain beauty in the process. I think, as I think Adam Savage at some point was talking about this, like that kind of, because he was one of those people that also worked in kind of the theater backstage and putting it all together. And he was kind of talking about how having kind of seen the inside of it, there's a certain beauty to what you see behind the scenes in making it and not just kind of the end result that everybody else sees.
Right. Yeah.
I love that. That's a great perspective. And dovetailing off of that you, in one of recent blog posts, talked about how a lot of times you're driven by your own curiosity. So you kind of aspire to being like open to it and the process of discovery. Walk us through your thinking here. Like, what drives your personal curiosity?
ADHD? I don't know. You know, one of the reasons that I landed in CSS specifically is it's not just a programming language, but it's a linguistic one. It's declarative. It's based on inferences and semantics. Like, we communicate, you know, in a lot of languages, 1M and 16 pixels, you might think of them as interchangeable. And in CSS, they're not interchangeable. They are sometimes the same thing, but they have very different meanings. And that sort of like semantic implications in the language are part of what keep me interested, right? Like, I studied writing. I feel like with CSS, I can write poetry that the browser can understand in some way under extreme constraints. I don't know. That's one thing that grabs my curiosity. Generally, it shifts, right? And so I like having a job that's set up. I think I very intentionally built my career around my ADHD, right? I run my own company. I've gotten involved in various places. I'm doing things that allow me to hyper-focus on, you know, well, how do colors work? And I get to focus on that for a couple months and really try to understand it. I get to follow that. Web components, those are interesting now. Let's play with that for a couple months and see what we discover. Yeah, so there's not one thing that I'm curious about, but I like when I have the opportunities to go like, oh, that sparked an idea. I want to follow it. What can I find down that path?
How do you foster that serendipitous discovery of finding these new things of like, hey, because especially in the web space, I've talked about this several times on the show that things are evolving very fast. It seems like, you know, every week there is some kind of new framework, there is a new standard popping up. So keeping up with it is hard, and that somehow you're finding the time to kind of immerse yourself in it and be good at it.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard. And I think I've gotten lucky in some ways around that. Early in Oddbird, we always had sort of a commitment to being part of an open source flow of ideas. So we've always taken some time at the company to think the open source tools that we use, that other people have provided, are improving our client work. We can move quicker for the client by using these open tools. So in paying that back, we consider it reasonable to contribute back to the projects and back to the open source world from client work. So in some ways, there's this open source feeds into the clients feed back into the open source, and we use one to help fund the other and one to support the other. So hopefully that's a balance. But being able to do that lets us play with a bunch of these open source projects. Some of them we've created, some of them other people have created and we contribute to. There's a local printmaker here in Denver. He runs a print shop, fancy printing. I can't think of the term right now where you lay out your wood tiles
sheets,
or whatever. Yeah, exactly, right? And when he started his company, he got two presses. And he said, this one is for clients, this one is for art, and that's how this shop runs. Client work funds the art. And it's how I think of my whole career. I don't know. I guess that back and forth, what I'm trying to say is that back and forth sort of like brings the creativity back into the client work and the tech work.
It's a symbiotic relationship, it seems. I do want to talk more about Oddbird. So you kind of mentioned that you did start a company. And for folks that are listening to this show, we have a lot of early in career or folks that are contemplating a career in the technology space. And oftentimes there's this kind of fear of like, well, if I go down the entrepreneurial path, am I missing out? Am I missing out on promotions? Am I missing out on opportunities? And you've kind of carved your own path with Oddbird, which you know, probably you can describe it best. It's a web design agency, like a web development agency. What inspired you to go down the path of entrepreneurship and starting your own business?
Well, I think part of it was that I wanted this level of freedom over my career and control. And it, you know, it's risky in some ways. I mean, I've never been promoted. I've been in this industry for 20 some years and I've never had a promotion, but I've also never been laid off because those sort of concepts don't apply. And I feel like on the one hand, it feels risky because you have to do it. And it relies on finding clients. And on the other hand, it's safer because I can have three clients and it's unlikely that they're all going to fire me at once. Right. So I get to build in some amount of job security that when you're working for a big corporation, they can just take away your job at any time. There's trade-offs there. When I was getting started, it seemed like the obvious thing for me. I mean, partially at that time, web development and tech as an industry were separate things. They felt separate. It was a very different time. And so I was building websites for people and my brothers were building websites for people. And we just thought, well, if we do this together, maybe we can build something. And I still think that could be a good path for people. I think you can do it on your own, but it's even better if you have a good team. And one of the things that we found was a lot of work comes through people looking for a particular backend, which is hard for me. But if I made contacts with people, I got to say, oh, well, my brother does this backend work. He's very good at that. I can find jobs by pointing to him. And when he would get somebody reaching out saying, you know, we want this sort of backend, and he'd say, what front end do you want? And they'd be like, I don't know, we got to find somebody. And he'd be like, no, my sister does that. So like having this team made it possible for us to sell a package that I think helped us out.
You mentioned freedom and control. And I want to kind of zero in a little bit on that. Like, what does it mean for you? Because you kind of mentioned freedom of, obviously, like you can seek out the clients that you want for your company. You can seek out the projects that you want for the company. What drives that? Like, because you're absolutely right. You know, you work for a bigger company. You give up like a large amount of freedom of control. You're at the mercy of whoever is leading the organization, the team, the bigger company, and in your case, you have kind of the reverse of that. You have more of it. So what drives it?
Part of it, going back to just, I don't know, ADHD personality, I have trouble doing things that I don't see the vision of. And so like, I know I'm going to do better work if I have to carry the vision by doing this sort of work, by choosing our clients. We ensure that we have some vision for doing the work. And that means we do better work. We get to not just do whatever the client asks for, but push back, ask questions, push them to be better, bring our expertise to whatever it is that they're doing, which was something that we had to learn early on, that clients are experts in their fields and we are coming in as experts in our field. Somehow we have to build something better combining the two of those. Choosing clients, it's always sort of a like, well, can we catch this vision? Can we catch the vision for the thing? And that can be in various different ways. It can be the social impact of the project, or it can be just, you know, a company needs an internal tool and we can help make their day-to-day life a little easier. It's a fun problem to solve.
I want to learn more about how you're thinking about the type of business that you're running, because in terms of entrepreneurs, and especially bootstrapped entrepreneurs, like in one of the recent conversations I had with Rob Walling, we're talking about like folks that bootstrap their business from scratch. They build a SaaS, and you know, it's like, I build a web app, people sign up for it, people pay with Stripe or whatever else, and that's it, right? Like, it's kind of a self-service autopilot thing. In your case, you are deeply engaged with clients and you had some pretty big names that work with you. It seems scary, right? Like to go out and be like, okay, like it's not just me putting together a website and saying, hey, everyone sign up. I like optimize the SEO and then people land on that page, sign up and they pay me. I actually need to talk to people, understand their requirements. So from the early days of your business, like how did you overcome this kind of barrier of like, okay, but now I need to go and actually talk to people and find those clients.
Yeah, that's the hardest part of it for sure. It turns out, I mean, we've found very much that just meeting people and talking to them and explaining your expertise, it's a slow way of doing sales, but it pays off. Like almost all of our clients, SEO does nothing for us. You know, we'll try to get a little bit better of a page rank, sure, whatever, it's good to show up. But our best clients always come from showing up at a conference, giving a talk, writing a good blog post, meeting somebody, having a in-person interaction. And then 3 years down the line, they are in some situation where they need help with a project. The team doesn't have enough capacity for it or whatever. And they think, oh, I know somebody who can do this sort of work, and they come back. So it's definitely all about that interactions and talking to people. And that can be hard for me as an introvert. but a big way to do it is to start writing about everything you're doing and then start submitting to conferences to talk about those things. And the great thing about presenting at a conference is I don't have to introduce myself to anybody. I stand on stage, I give my presentation, and then I go stand in the hallway and somebody will come talk to me if they're interested. So I don't have to be naturally outgoing for those conversations to happen. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a trade-off there in terms of what kind of work you do as an independent company. The great thing about client work is it's immediately funded. Right? Like if you try to build your own SaaS, you have to upfront all the work and then hope that you make it back. And the advantage of client work is it's direct. You get paid as you put in the hours. I think those are a trade-off. And I think there's a lot of companies that have tried to sort of do both or move from one to the other. And I think that's an interesting model. And we're looking at that too. We've got an internal project we're working on. And we've been able to do a lot of open source work that's helped as our marketing. So it can be useful to use the client work to then help fund other sorts of projects so that you can bootstrap. It's still that two-press model. Can we use the income over here to help fund something else we want to do over here?
What is interesting here too is you called out the fact that there is a degree of using kind of your leverage as a speaker and as a writer to attract clients. And that's an interesting angle to me because it's a non-obvious one, because not a lot of people think of, oh, I go to a conference to speak, and then you build that authority and domain. That's like, oh, if I want to talk CSS, Miriam is the person I want to talk to because they very clearly understand the subject matter and they're the expert. And there's a talk that I can point to and say, look, they presented at this conference and I want to go and kind of like do exactly what they're talking about. Was that kind of an epiphany that occurred to you like early on? It's like building this authority online builds out the potential client base? Or did you arrive at it more kind of organically over time?
We found it early on, but organically. I mean, it was my brother soon after we started became a Django core developer, and he was speaking at PyCon and DjangoCon, and we found that we were getting a lot of our clients through those conferences. It was somebody that he had lunch with at a conference. We sort of ended up going all in on that approach. We're gonna write about what we're doing. We're gonna go give talks about what we've learned. I've also had a very strong rule. Like when I was first invited to speak, it was because I had built the Suzy framework for CSS grids. A lot of the invites were like, will you come talk about Suzy? And I made a little rule for myself that I didn't want to do a sales pitch on stage. Nobody's interested. So I would say I will write talks that are things that I learned from maintaining an open source project or things that I learned about CSS layout, but I will never give a talk selling my product. I think that worked out well for me. Being like, I'm going to try to give you something useful in the talk that you can then do something with instead of telling you to use my thing. But yeah, we've focused on that and I think it's worked pretty well for us.
I like that approach as well, because as the trope goes, developers are allergic to marketing. right? Like, nobody, like, if you talk to any of the kind of the technologists, like, and you talk to them, like, well, how did you find about this tool or this framework? It's very rarely, it's like, oh yeah, I drove past a billboard or some like YouTube ad. It's always like, oh no, I talked to this other engineer. I talked to this other, I saw this conference talk and they mentioned it, or somebody on like, I don't know, Reddit, Hacker News, you name it. It's a very, I think it's admirable that you kind of, you're not getting into the world of like, hey, let's transform everything into a marketing talk. It's more of like, let me talk about the actual problem, how we're solving it. And if you're interested in it, by all means, let's talk more.
And something to know about that approach. And I think generally, if you're running your own client work company, agency, consulting agency of any kind, really the things you talk about are the kind of work you're going to get. Don't talk about something you don't want to do. Talk about something you do want to do. Like when I was giving more design system talks, we got more design system work. You know, if we want more design system work, I should start giving design system talks again. There's a real direct connection of what you're talking about and what sort of work you get. And the same is true with the clients that you put in your portfolio. Doing a project that you hate for exposure isn't going to work because you'll be asked to do the same sort of work over and over. Do projects that are the kind of work you want to do, and those will help you get the next project that you want to do. Really, really making sure that you're telling people the thing that you want to do is important for this kind of work.
So in that regard, I would love to learn more from you about kind of the balance between specializing in something or being a bit more of a generalist. Because as you described, like there could be many projects, and especially in a space that has so much opportunity like the web, and I'm painting a very broad brush intentionally, like it's the web, it's this magical thing that exists somewhere. How do you balance between like being specialized in something versus I know a little bit of everything and I can kind of put pieces together? Like where does the balance is for you?
I think there are ways to make it work either way, probably. We have felt like we want to specialize in a certain type of problem solving and be generalists when it comes to the technologies we're willing to use. Like we're more interested in how do you think about building tools for people to use? That's what we do. We will help you figure out how to build a tool that somebody has to use. And then we'll draw on whatever tools we can use to make that possible. For us, that's what's worked. But I think we built that around our own interests, right? We don't care that much about being specialized in React Native or like some very narrow set of tooling. We're more interested in the problem solving and we're happy to learn whatever languages are necessary. Maybe another way to say it is you don't have to choose between being a generalist and a specialist. Sometimes you can specialize in something that also, it's also good to have a broad knowledge. I think some people think of me as a specialist because I've gone very deep in CSS, but also I run a theater company and a band, and I've worked as a designer and I've worked as an engineer and I can write some JavaScript. I don't know. You don't have to choose. It's useful to go deep sometimes. It's useful to go broad sometimes. I don't think there's one answer there.
It's a shifting spectrum, basically. Like depending on kind of the domain, you can pull the slider in one direction or the other.
Right. Yeah. And you can highlight your expertise when that's useful and highlight your generality when that's useful.
I really like that. I know we're getting close to time, and I have a question that I ask of all my guests. And this has been a great conversation, and I think this is going to be a good note to wrap it up. And that is, if you think of an unconventional piece of advice, somebody is listening to this show, they think, wow, Miriam is inspiring. I want to do that. What would be your advice to this individual listening?
Well, I don't know what's unconventional, but I do feel like the thing that I want to inspire people about is that you get to, I don't even know if this is always true. You get to within your constraints. You know, we all have different set of life constraints, but you get to choose what you're going to do with that. You're allowed to build your own way of doing things. You're allowed to, I mean, for me, that was like, I want to be able to take a month off and make a show with my theater company. So how do I build my career around that? I want to be able to have my afternoons to think about an art project. How do I build a career that gives me that? And it takes trade-offs. I'm not saying that it's easy or you get everything. I have turned down a lot of money to get to do what I want with my time. And it's a good trade-off for me. And you get to make those trade-offs. You get to decide those things. You don't have to go work for Apple. You don't have to go work for Google. It's not the only path. You get to come up with your own paths. And they're not always going to work out, but you're allowed to try things. You're even allowed to fail at them and then try something else. That's fine. I know that can feel hard and risky because you also have to buy food and sleep somewhere, but you're allowed to try.
You're allowed to try. I love that advice. And I think it's, if there's anything that is words of encouragement, then this is it. Like, this is your permission to try. Miriam, for folks that want to follow your adventures online, that want to learn more about your company, where should they go?
Yeah, you can go to oddbird.net, or you can follow me. I'm on Mastodon, Mia at frontendsocial, front-end.social. And Oddbird is also on frontendsocial, so you can follow us there. Definitely reach out if you're interested. Come find me at a conference. Love to talk.
Yeah, this is fantastic. And we'll make sure to include all the links in the show notes as well. So make sure to check out the description of this video or in whatever the podcast app that you're listening this in, because all the links are going to be there. Miriam, it's been a delight talking to you today. Thank you so much for making the time.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Thank you for having me.